This is Debbie Dane, and I'm speaking with Stephen Peters on Monday, June 2nd, 1986. We're beginning the interview at 3:30, and we're about to interview Stephen Peters about his immigration experience from Albania in 1920. He was 14 years old and is archive number 177.
Do you need light there? We can put that light on.
I'm fine, thank you.
Are we switched back? Okay, I'm ready. We're going?
Go.
Mr. Peters, we'll start at the beginning. Where were you born, what town, and when?
I was born in 1906 in a little village in southern Albania called Tresk. I was the third of 10 children my father had, my father and mother. When I was 6 years old, the Balkan War started. So I went to school between 1912, when I was 6 years old, until 1917, when we lost everything. I had only 2 years of schooling. And those 2 years were in a Greek school, because there were no Albanian school allowed. So I was really illiterate. When I came to this country in 1920. My father was a fairly well-to-do gentleman farmer and businessman. Then in 1916, the area where we came from became a no-man's land. The French were on one side and the Austrians on the other. And they exterminated everything that we had. The houses were burned down, our livestock was lost. So in April of 1917, we had to flee as refugees. We had, all we could take with us were what we could load on two mules. And we came to near a city called Korçë, which is a large city in southern Albania. But we couldn't get into the city because it was French. We crossed into French territory. We couldn't get into the city because the French had surrounded it with barbed wire. So we had to stay in a village near there. This was in the summer of 1917. We almost starved to death. In fact, one of my brothers, a tiny little brother, 6 months old, died of starvation because we couldn't find anything to eat.
While you were waiting there?
We were waiting to get into the city. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing to buy. There was no... we could get beans... and grind out the beans and try to make bread, but the taste was awful. In any case, finally we got into the city in Korçë. This was in September of 1917. And there I managed to go 1 year in an Albanian school. When the war was over, my father already sent my oldest brother here in the United States in 1915. So when the war was over, we received notice from my brother that he was ready to send us money if there was some way to send it to Albania. And we found means, and he sent $400.
What was he doing? What was his job here?
Oh, well, he was working as in a shoe factory somewhere. So that really revived us. And then my father decided that it was time for me to go and earn a living here and also help the family back home. So on May the 15th, 1920, an agent of a shipping company, an Italian shipping company, collected 48 of us, mostly children, if I call myself a child, and women. And there were only four male adults in the group. And we waited all day for the Korçë. That area there was still a part of, occupied by France, even though it was 1920. There was really no Albanian state as yet. So we waited all day outside the city there. The French trucks, which had promised to come, never came. So the next day, we tried again, and the French trucks did come. We were loaded in trucks and crossed into Greece, Florida, Greece. to take a train. Albania had no railroads in those days. There was a train which came from Yugoslavia, but the passenger cars were completely filled. So they added two cattle cars, and they put us into those cattle cars. And we went to Salonika, Greece. From there, there was a better train. We went to Athens.
Let me stop you just for just a second. You were 14 years old.
Yes.
You'd left your family.
That's right.
Put on a train with complete strangers into...
No, well, I wouldn't say strangers, because all these 48 people came from the same area.
Uh-huh.
It was one group, all from the same villages.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, most of them either were cousins, and there was an uncle who had been in the United States with
uh-huh.
me.
What were your thoughts when you said goodbye to your parents?
Well, actually, I didn't want to go, and my father had to push me into the truck because I was scared. But it was a matter of either staying there and starving or coming here.
But could you understand that as a 14-year-old?
Yes, you could. I can understand. I'd been working for the last 2 years doing all kinds of chores in the city there. So no, I was pretty mature for that age. Actually, I think my father made me a little older than I was, because he had heard that in the United States you could not have a full job if you were under 14. So he might have made me a little older in the passport. I had a French laissez-passer, they called it. It wasn't passport. In any case, I understood pretty well. I knew. And finally, we landed in Patras, Greece, 3 days after we left, or 3 or 4 days. And there, a shipping company, or the doctor of a shipping company, examined all of us. We didn't have any reservations as yet, but the agent who was taking care of us had been in contact with an Italian shipping company, Kostlich Shipping Lines from Trieste, Italy. And a doctor examined us soon after we arrived in Patras, and they found me and some others to have trichoma. And the doctor said, you can never go to the United States. You'll never pass Ellis Island. He mentioned Ellis Island. That's the first time I heard of Ellis Island. But since there was no way of going anyhow, there was no, we didn't have any reservations anywhere. He said, well, I'll treat you for $25. And by the time you are ready to go, you'll be all right. So I began treatment along with some others for just trichoma. I didn't have TB because he was looking for TB too, the doctor. And we stayed in Patras from about the 18th or 19th of May until the 28th of June. I was taking this treatment, and all the rest of them were waiting.
And where would you stay? Did they put you up in the steamship?
No, there was a cheap hotel on the harbor there, a very cheap hotel with mice running around. And we all stayed in one single hotel. The shipping company put us in there. I don't know how much, paid maybe a dollar a day or something.
And would they check with you? Would you check every day to see if there was a boat that day?
No. It was decided that we would go on a boat that would leave Patras on the 28th of June. That is 6 weeks later. So we stayed there, and I recall we used to buy a little canned salmon brought from the United States and sold in the Greek market, and grapes and things of that kind, whatever we could find. But always ate in the rooms where we lived. So finally, on the 20th of June, a boat came from Trieste, Italy. And the name of the boat was President Wilson. Under the President Wilson, you could read that the real name was Emperor Francis Joseph, the name of the boat. Apparently, the boat had been seized during the war in Trieste by Italy and changed the name from Emperor Francis Joseph to President Wilson. In any case, we got on the boat. The boat had three classes. There was a first class, small, second class, a little larger, and then steerage, or third class. That's where we were. There were two huge rooms, and they had bunks. And we slept in those bunks. Most of the passengers were Italian, the Albanians and some Greeks, but most of them were Italians, very poor. There we were fed twice a day. We ate spaghetti and some wine for at 8 o'clock in the morning, and spaghetti and wine at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And this lasted from June the 28th until about the 16th of July when we arrived in New York. We stopped. The boat sailed from Trieste and then Patras, Greece, and then Naples, where it took a large number of Italians. Then we stopped again in Algiers for call, and then again in the Azores for call, and then finally in New York. We arrived in New York on a beautiful, I think it was July the 16th, a beautiful dawn, and the first thing I saw was the Statue of Liberty. It was a magnificent sight, awesome sight, and also the skyscrapers. I can never forget the Bowery. As soon as we arrived, we were told that we'd had to wait on the boat for at least 3 days before we could disembark, because the harbor was just replete with boats come from all over Europe. You see, there was no limit in those days as to the number of people who could come to the United States. We didn't need any visas of any kind. All you had to do is to have a passport, that's all. So the day after we arrived, people from Public Health Service came. They weren't doctors, and examined us and found that we had lice. Most of us had lice on our hairs and all over. So they packed all of us, all of the Albanian group, 48, I don't know what they did with the Italians and so on, and took us to a little island not very far, somewhere there on the harbor. I don't know what the name of the island was. And they undressed us and gave us pajamas. We looked like prisoners. And shaved our heads and washed us, and then threw our clothes into a oven. Now, they couldn't shave the women's heads, so they washed their heads with gasoline. And we stayed there overnight. They gave us the clothes back, and we were sent back on the boat and stayed 2 more days. And we were watching Ellis Island. The boat was out in the harbor there, and we could see Ellis Island, the place we were hoping to get, and it looked beautiful. I could see the lawns today were green and manicured perfectly. Finally, the day came. It was a Sunday morning. They said, "We are going now," and I was shivering because I didn't know what. Personally, whether I was going to pass or not because of my trachoma problem. In any case, we were put on a large ferry thing, I think it was a ferry boat, and taken to the island, to the Ellis Island, and disembarked there. We were only a small group in comparison with a large number of other people. All over the sidewalks, in line, in preparations for going up to the clinic for examination. And the noise and the languages were absolutely incomprehensible. That scared me more than anything else. Another thing that scared me before we were sent to Ellis Island was watching from the boat the people who were working in the piers. And in those days, you know, not practically everything was done by hand. And I would see these porters with huge trunks on their backs, and I was saying to myself, how can I do this? See, I was expecting to be a laborer, naturally. And that scared me a lot, watching these porters or whatever they were with huge baggages on their back. In any case, we landed, and then finally our turn came. We were lined up outside in one of the sidewalks there. It was a beautiful day, Sunday, until our turn came. Then we were lined up and sent to an upper room. And there was the clinic, the doctors, there were a large number of doctors there, nurses. And as I recall very clearly, the doctor undressed me up to here. I had some homespun clothes made by my mother, and examined me thoroughly, and I was shivering. And I could listen to the doctor telling something to the nurse, but I didn't understand what they were. I spoke only Albanian and some Greek. I couldn't understand a word of English, of course, not a single word. So he examined. I recall he put something on my chest in here thoroughly. And then when he was examining my eyes, I began shivering because I was afraid. I noticed that the other doctors who were examining some of the members of our group were putting an X on some of the on the lapels. And I was told beforehand that if you get an X, you go back to the boat. And so I didn't know what was going to happen. Finally, the doctor said, put the dress on, by sign, and he put no cross on my lapel, and I passed. Then, when the whole group had passed through, we were sent down. The noise was deafening, because there were children crying and women crying. Those people who had X's were sent to a room there, and that was awful to listen to the noise. I just don't know where that room was, but it must have been on the same level. In any case, after we finished the examination, we were sent down to a huge hall, and it had not desks, but benches. And you sat on those benches and you pulled through. At the end of the hall, there were the examiners. And as each one, all of us speaking the same language, were put in one row. And we're examined. Each one of us was examined. When I went there, he asked me what language I spoke, and I didn't understand what he said. But he had a Greek interpreter there, and he knew I came from Albania. He saw it in the little French passport I had. So he told the Greek interpreter to ask me where I was going, and I told him I was going to Boston. And who was waiting for me there? And I said I had an older brother and an uncle in Boston. And then he asked me whether I had $25 with me, and I showed him $25. Then he wrote on a small card, 2x4, my name and the place where I was going. It was 21 Wall Street, as I recall, West End, Boston, and he pinned that on my lapel here. And said go through, and that was the end of that.
Amazing.
And after everybody passed, we were taken to what looked like a restaurant. There were tables there, and we were given the best sandwiches I ever ate in my life. There were these Red Cross women, I think, well-dressed, old women, very sweet, and they gave us ham sandwiches. And they gave us, I recall, eating an orange and an apple. It was fantastic. Finally, after we had something to eat, they gave us milk, too. Oh, it was good. I felt then that I was in the United States. So the whole of us were then put on a tugboat or some kind of a ferry boat and taken to Bowery. Some of these women, old women, were accompanying us. In the Bowery, we were taken down to the subway. And that was scary. I've never seen a subway in my life, never heard of a subway car. And the noise, because the windows were open, there was no air conditioning apparently in those days. The windows of the subway trains were open. The noise was awful. In any case, I was, as I recall, shivering all the time. Finally, we got to the railroad station. It was Grand Central Station. And there, these women helped us get into the... Well, we bought tickets, $5. I recall, of my $25, $5 were gone. And we're all loaded into a train. And 4 or 5 hours later that evening, Sunday, we arrived in Boston, South Station. And then from there, my uncle, who was with me, and another man had been in the United States before and had gone back to Albania to get married and came back. They knew how to take the subway elevator. We took, actually it was the elevator in Boston, and took us to North Station. Then from there we walked to where my brother and my uncle lived, in the worst slum you ever saw in your life. And this was 21 Wall Street, near Causeway Street, near North Station. And there I met my brother. I hadn't seen him for 4 years. He was 5 years older than I was. And well, that was it.
Do you remember, I'll start backwards because I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Did you remember what your brother even looked like? I mean,
No, he had changed so much. He looked so grown up, so well dressed and so on. He said, "You are with me." He tried to make me feel at home. He tried to. He and four other men were living in in one of those tenement houses built by the factories for cheap labor, on the fourth floor. They were brick buildings, but attached. They were all men, because women, all of them were single. There were three bedrooms there and a kitchen. The bedrooms had no light. The kitchen had a gas light. And had a stove. There was cold running water. No central heating, of course. And we were six in that apartment. There were five when I came to, and I was the sixth. Two slept in one room, three in another room, and one in another room. And there was no bathroom. There were two apartments there. We occupied one, and another one on the other side was occupied by an Italian family of about six or seven children. And in the hallway there was a commode, and we had to use that as a bathroom. So we had to wait in line very often. For bath, well, there were free showers in North End near the North Church. So every Saturday afternoon after we came back from work, we took a piece of soap and a towel. Excuse me for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
We used to take a piece of soap and a towel and walk down from West End to, do you know Boston? Have you ever been? From West End to North End, where the Italians lived. West End was a Jewish ghetto with some Albanians and a few Italians, but mostly Jewish, poor Jewish from Eastern Europe. We used to go to the public bath there and take a shower. That was our weekly chore. We had to do that every week, otherwise we stunk. Well, I stayed a week with my brother, He was working, of course, in a shoe factory until he found me a job in another factory in South Boston, shoe factory. So I began working a week after I got here. It was piecework. All I had to do is shoes came to me through a belt, and I had to put them through a lathe to see that they fitted. If they fitted, okay, otherwise I threw them out on the side. I didn't need any language of any kind. It was purely piecework. I worked there for a while, making about $6 or $7 a week, because it was piecework. And then I realized that wasn't enough. So across the street was a huge American can company. And some of the boys who came with me were working there. And they said, look, we are making $14 a week in here. So I left the shoe factory and went there and worked for 2 years. It was hard work, and I still have cuts all over my hands because they had no protective devices of any kind, no labor unions to protect you, of course, in those days. And I stayed there for a couple of years.
Were you able to send money home during this? Or?
Oh, yes. Everything we made, we sent... everything we made, actually. We bought secondhand stuff. I recall my brother bought me a secondhand. There were Jewish little Jewish shops around there on Causeway Street, which sold secondhand shoes and secondhand clothing and so on. So we bought secondhand stuff. And anything we could save, we send them back home. In any case, after 2 years of this American can factory, one of the boys who came with me had found that the best place to work was in a restaurant, because you can eat there well. So one Sunday he said, come with me. He said, I'll get you a job in Child's restaurant. In those days, Child's restaurants were well-known. They don't exist anymore. So on a Sunday morning, I went there and I began washing dishes. And I ate wonderful chicken and so on. So I didn't go back to the American Can Company. I stayed there. And
were you able to learn English during this
time? Well, I was going to tell you about that. I came in here in July. Then in September, I began going to school in the afternoon after work. And that's when I began learning English. There was a grammar school around the corner there on Normer Street, and I began going in September of 1920. The teachers were wonderful. They knew how to handle us. All of us were immigrants, either Italians or Albanians or Jewish boys and girls. So I began picking up English very quickly. And as I said, I only about an average of about 3 years of schooling when I came here. So by 1924, I finished grammar school and I got a diploma, which I still have. Washington Elementary School in Boston, going evenings after work until about 9 o'clock at night. In any case, after working a couple of years at the American Can Company, I went to work in a restaurant, first washing dishes and then washing floors and so on. And in the meantime, I was improving in my language and so on. And I became a waiter. That was quite an advancement for me. That is, from washing dishes to a waiter. In the meantime, my brother had made me a member of YMCA. And that was really a tremendous change in my life. Because while I was a member of the YMCA, and when I finished when I got through with my grammar school, I was told by somebody there that I could go to high school at the YMCA if I could afford to pay $50.
Okay.
This is the end of side one. Mr. Peters, number 177. This is the beginning of side two. Mr. Peters, number 177. It's 4 o'clock.
You were saying $50, and you could...
Well, go to school there instead of going to a public high school in Boston. So I registered. The name of the school was Northeastern Prep School. Actually, it was part of Northeastern University, because Northeastern University in those days had only about 600 students, and it met. It was part of the YMCA, actually. And our classes were in the YMCA building. 316 Huntington Avenue. It's still there. So I enrolled in at the prep school. This was in 1926. That is, I stayed out. I finished my grammar school in 1924 and then worked a couple of years. And I began going to the prep school. In 1929, when I was a junior, my English teacher said, "Look, what are you going to do the rest of your life?" I said, "Work as a waiter in a restaurant." They said, "Forget it. You should go to college." I said, "How can I?" He said, "Take the college entrance examination. And I said, "Where should I go?" He said, "Go to the best." He was actually, this English teacher was working for PhD at Harvard. He was somewhere from the Midwest, Middle West. He was really wonderful. So in 1929, in June, I took the College Board, and I applied to at Harvard. But I didn't have the money to go the first year. So I applied, and Mrs. Pennypecker, who was then dean of admission, told me that I didn't have, my grades weren't high enough for a scholarship. But she suggested that, why didn't I work a year and then enroll the following year? So I did, continued working as a waiter. By the end of the year, I had saved $400. That's all you needed for a tuition fee. And in September 1930, and I was admitted as a freshman with a class of 34.
And did you surprise yourself? I mean, could you?
No, I took it everything as it came along. Going at Harvard was quite an experience. I majored in English and social studies. It was fantastic. Harvard in those days had some of the best professors. George Lyman Kittredge, for instance, was teaching Shakespeare. I had his course every single year while I was there. So I got my AB in 34, and then I decided to get an EDM, Master of Education, so I stayed 2 more years, Graduate School of Education. And in 36, I got my EDM, and applied for a job in the Boston school system. And I got a job there, but in the meantime, I decided to visit my family because my family was still in Albania, except another brother had arrived in 1930, but the rest of the family, my father, mother, and 3 or 4 other children, were still in Albania. So I decided to go to visit them during the summer. I had saved enough money. So I left at the end of June and went to the capital city, Tirana. And somebody told me there that I should go and see King Zog because he was looking for educated people. Well, I hesitated to do that because I didn't have a good impression of Zog. But I decided to go and see the Minister of Education. So I went there, and he convinced me to stay in Albania for a while and trying to introduce the American educational methods at a teacher's college in Elbasan. So I wrote back to the school board in Boston and said that I decided to stay in Albania for a while. So I stayed there for about 3 years. until March of 1939. And I was a professor of education at the teachers' college, the only teachers' college they had in Elbasan. And then I came back here. But one of the main reasons, really, I wanted to stay in Albania was to try to get my family back in the States. And if I stayed there, the pay was excellent. They paid very well, all in gold. So I began sending my family here. First, I sent my mother, because in order to bring the children here, outside of the quota, you had to have the parents here. So first, I sent my mother here. And she joined my two other brothers in Boston, one of whom was already married. And then after she was here for 6 months, she applied for one of my sisters and one of my brothers. So they came here in 1937. So half of the family, more than half the family was here. Then in 1938, I came back here with my younger sister, just for the summer. And I went back in September after the Munich disaster. And I stayed there until, I stayed in Albania until March 15, when Hitler, 1939, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia, and I left. I was very friendly with the American minister in Tirana. A man, also a Harvard graduate, told me to get out and go back to the United States, so I left. But I left behind my father and a younger brother. In any case, we managed to get the younger brother here in 1940 before Mussolini got into the war. But my father got stuck there. And I went to Albania in 1944 with working for OSS. I found him alive. And I sent him back here.
Oh, so I was so relieved. I understand.
In any case, the whole family then was in the United States. So I don't know what more can I tell you.
Well, I've got a few questions.
Sure.
It's an incredible story. But just for the record also, then... you did work for the State Department.
Oh, yes. Well, when I got out of the Army at the end, well, during the war, I was drafted into the Army in early 1942, soon after Pearl Harbor. And I was sent to Kansas, Camp Phillips, in the 94th Infantry Division. Then during the summer, the OSS was created, Office of Strategic Services. And they were apparently going around the universities looking for people who spoke the languages. So they apparently found my name at Harvard. So one day while we were in maneuvers in Tennessee somewhere with the 94th Division, an order came to the commanding officer there saying that I should be sent to Kansas City for an interview. So he sent me there, a staff car, and I was given an address, and I went and knocked. It was in the basement somewhere in Kansas City, Kansas. I knocked at the door. There was a tiny little ear. A woman, a girl, opened the door. It was like a speakeasy. Mm-hmm. And asked me who I was, and then I showed her the traveling papers. And she opened the door and she said, wait here. The colonel will see you in a minute. So after about 15 or 20 minutes, the colonel called me in his office. And he said, we have an organization which is looking for people to work behind the lines. And he said, we understand you speak several languages and we'd like to have you join it. But he said, it's a spy work, and it's a dangerous, risky work. We'll ship you behind the lines. Whether you'll come back or not, we don't know. And he said, think it over and come and tell me tomorrow. So he sent me to a hotel. I thought the situation over. I was fed up with the infantry. It was hard work. So I decided during the night that it was best to join the SS, whatever it was, rather than stay in the infantry. So I told the colonel that I'll join. And he said, okay, I'll send you back to the division and we'll notify Washington and see what they're going to say. So about 2 weeks later, the order came from Washington to be shipped back to Q Building. Q Building is where the Werra Gate is now. And that's where the headquarters of YSS used to be. They were just... I was formally still in the army, still... one night, I stayed 2 or 3 days somewhere up there in Q Building. One night, a group of us were loaded in a bus, huge army bus, with Curtiss Drone. We left Washington about 12 at night and taken somewhere in Virginia. It took about 3 hours in a camp for training. Even today, I don't know where the camp was. We were trained there for about 2 weeks, how to survive, and how to build bridges, and how to do spy work, how to collect information, how to send it. We're taught how to code and decode, encode and decode messages, and to use radio transmitters and so on. So after 2 weeks, that's the only training we had. We were sent to Hampton Roads, and they're shipped on a Liberty ship to Oran, Algiers, which had already been taken over by our armed forces. So we landed in Algiers about a month after we left Hampton Roads. It was a convoy of about 150 Liberty ships, and it zigzagged. That's really, it took so long to get to Oran. Finally, we landed in Oran, stayed there for a little while in the Lion Mountains, overlooking the Mediterranean, and then from there we were shipped to Egypt for more training before infiltrated into the Balkans, where we headed for. Stayed in Cairo for a little while. They trained us more how to parachute from airplanes and so on. And finally, they shipped us to Italy. The shipping to Italy was an interesting revelation to me. We left Alexandria for Taranto. Taranto had already been taken over by our armed forces. And it was a luxury ship. It had three classes: first class, second class, and third class, run by the British. The first two classes contained a few British and American officers, and I was an officer. And the third class contained about 3,000 Australians and New Zealanders. We, up in the second house, in the second class, there was first class too for generals, had several meals a day of a menu here. We had ham and eggs or bacon and eggs for breakfast, and then tea for lunch for about 11 o'clock, and then dinner, they called it, 1 to 2, and 4 o'clock, tea again with cookies and supper, and tea again 11 o'clock. The ranks had two meals a day, one about 8 o'clock, one at 4 o'clock. And I asked the British officers, how come the difference? And there was no complaint of any kind. Well, they said, we pay for it, and they don't. That's the only explanation they had. But that was the class structure of the British Army, because this was the 6th Army, or the 8th Army, the Montgomery's 8th Army. I'll never forget that. But somewhere along in my library upstairs, I think I have a menu of that. In any case, from Italy, from Taranto, we went to Bari. And then from Bari, John Hamilton, Captain John Hamilton, who died last week, was running the blockade from Italy into the Balkans every single night. Now, you know who Jim Hamilton was? Or he is? There was a long obituary of him in the Post last week. Sterling Hayden.
Oh, yes. Played... Oh, Sterling Hayden?
Yeah, he was... His name, his real name was John...
Of course, he won Silver Stars. He
was that's the man. He took us across the border. He was fantastic in reading charts. Huh. And he never lost a man. He was a captain in those days. And he was married to this beautiful Madeline Carroll. And she was in Bari working... she was a beautiful actress, but she wanted to be near him. And she was working in USO and serving coffee and donuts to the GIs. Well, Hamilton, I knew Hamilton pretty well. He took us across to Vis in Yugoslavia, or Tito was. And then from there I went to Albania. In any case, when I stayed in Albania from until September 1945, we had a mission there, OSS mission. And when I came back, then instead of going back to teaching in Boston, I joined the State Department and stayed there until I retired 30 years later.
Okay, we have about 10 or 15 minutes to fill in some spaces and get your thoughtful analysis of your life. A couple of questions that are historical in nature. When did you become an American citizen?
In 1947, when I was 21 years of age.
While you were at Harvard?
No, I was in high school then. You see, I didn't get into Harvard until 1930.
Right.
So in 1927, I became an American citizen.
Was that your idea, or...?
That was an expectation. In those days, you could not become an American citizen until you were 21. And you had to have been in the country at least 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I was looking forward to that. That was a big day. I'll never forget the day we I went with two witnesses to the federal building in Boston on State Street. And there were only three or four of us. And I was given an examination about American history and a piece from the Constitution, as I recall, to read. And the judge gave us a little speech about what America meant. And said, now you're an American citizen. So I became an American citizen in 1927.
Was it?
I have that. I haven't framed it, but I will frame it. Mm-hmm. My citizenship papers. The reason I haven't framed it is that occasionally I need it. Mm-hmm. I have no birth certificate. And that's the only birth certificate I have. So.
You had done this all on your own. You were 14 when you came. Your family was still in Albania.
Yeah, except for my older brother.
For your brother.
Yeah.
And yet you seemed so directed. Was it, what were the influences? Was it just who you were, or?
I don't know. We had this idea that you had to work. And I just took it for granted that I had to work. And the education came without my even being aware of it, really. This English teacher, I think, played a major part, and also, strangely enough, an article, an editorial in the Boston Globe. On Sunday mornings, I used to go to, I was a member of the YMCA, and Sunday mornings, I used to go, because I didn't work on Sundays, I used to go to the YMCA in the lobby there to read the Globe free. And one day, the Sunday Globe in those days had a two-column editorial signed Uncle Dudley. And this particular editorial spoke about ennobling, the title of it, I'll never forget the title of it, Ennoble Yourself. And it talked about education per se as the value of education, and that really did tremendously for me. I discussed that article, I recall, with my English teacher, because he had already given me the idea that I shouldn't stop my education in 1929 or 1930 when I graduated from Northeastern Prep. but to go on. But that played a major part, that very article. And I recall when I got my EDM in 1936 from Harvard Graduate School of Education, I wrote a letter to the Globe stating that I owed a part of my education to that particular article. And I got a beautiful letter back from Uncle Dudley. I don't know who Uncle Dudley was. That was a pen name. So the education, but there may be also the fact that my father was quite an educated person. He had he was a Greek scholar. He had attended Greek schools, and he was an educated person. Maybe that had something to do with it, even though because of the war, he had no chance to send us to school. See, the Balkan War started in 1912, and then 1914, the World War started, so he had... He couldn't educate his children the way that his father had educated him. Mm-hmm. But we probably got the idea that education was part of the family. That may have been part of it. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't conscious of these. I just did things as they came along. Mm-hmm.
Then another thought. You've worked internationally, and you went back to your home country, and yet your success has been made through American institutions.
That's right, yeah.
So I guess I'm asking you to be thoughtful about your heritage and what does it mean for you to be Albanian and American.
Well, I don't feel Albanian anymore. Mm-hmm. No, that I never feel Albanian. I speak the language fluently, but I never use it. Mm-hmm. My children don't speak one single word of language. I have two children. Mm-hmm. I have a son who graduated from Harvard in 1968. And then went to medical school, and he's there now.
This one with the glasses?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he lives in McLean. Mm-hmm. He's a very successful doctor. And I have a beautiful daughter. She's up there somewhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Way at the top.
Yes, I see it. Blonde?
Yeah. Yes. She is... she graduated from Berkeley with Phi Beta Kappa and is now a bank... inspector in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Both of them got their education abroad, mostly in Italy. And my son graduated from the Notre Dame International School in Rome before he went to Harvard. It was high school in Rome, run by the Brothers of the Holy Cross, same as Notre Dame University, part of Notre Dame University High School. And my daughter went to, have you been to Rome? No. Mm-hmm. Oh, you have. At the top of the Spanish Steps, there is a school there next to the... There is a cathedral there and a school. And she went to that school until she came back here and went to Smith. Then from Smith, she transferred to Berkeley, where she didn't have any dates at Smith. There are too many girls in there. So she went to Berkeley and got us. She's very successful, both of them. My son has a tremendous house in McLean, built it a few years ago. It cost him $500,000, more than $500,000.
Wow. Now, this speaks to my... I want you... To America. I mean, this was an opportunity.
Of course. It's only here they can do it. No other place you can... A poor little boy... I don't have a picture of the time, but I recall I was a scary little thing when I came here with a cap on. And woolen trousers and woolen jacket made by my mother, because we didn't have any money to buy it. It just happened. Only here. I don't think if I had stayed in Albania, I would have been just nothing. I'm sure of that. But the chances you have here, the only thing you have to do is to work. That's all. To work, and that's what I teach part time now in the Fairfax Public Schools, and that's what I tell the boys and the girls. All you have to do is to work, mm-hmm. and keep away from trouble, and you'll succeed.
When did you first think of yourself as an American?
When I got my citizenship papers, I really felt an American then. But I have never felt an Albanian since then. Of course, maybe the marriage, too. I married a girl from South Carolina, so an American girl. Tremendous beauty. And now I have felt that I belonged here. As I said, I was supposed to have been 14, but whether I was 14 or not, you know, there were no there are no vital statistics in Albania, what they were in at that time. And I have a suspicion that my father may have made me, when he got the laissez-passer, the passport from French, a little older, so that he knew that you had to be 14 years of age in order to get a full-time job here. But in any case, my my age is as 1906. That's how it is in my citizenship papers. How did I get my name? That's fascinating. My name in the passport was Stefan Petro. In Albania, we had no last names. You had your first name and your father's name. And that's how it was in my laissez-passer. Then when I registered here in Boston, in the grammar school there, Boston Elementary School, the teacher, I gave her my little passport, French passport. She said, "Oh, this is Stephen." And Peter, she says, "Peters." And she wrote Stephen Peters, and that's how my name stuck. And the rest of the family is Stephen Peters. All my brothers have Peters from Petro, which is the same.
I don't want to get in. That's one.
I'm 26.
I don't want to get in.
Yeah, I'm 26.
Okay, we've got a couple more minutes. I keep thinking we're going to run out, so I'm not encouraged.
Do we have to? How much more time do I have?
We have about 3 more minutes.
Let's see. I have any questions?
Well, one that I feel comfortable asking you. When you came here, did you feel, were you treated as an outsider? Were you discriminated against?
No, no discrimination of any kind. That's because where I lived, we are all immigrants. I don't think there were any, of course, the in Boston, the Bostonians, the real Brahmins, lived on Beacon Hill, which was up not very far from West End. But where I lived, we're all foreigners. And there was no indication of any, and there were no blacks. The blacks lived, the black colony in Boston was very tiny in those days, and they lived in the South End somewhere. So there were no blacks in either in the elementary school or in the high school. Of course, there were no blacks in high school anyhow. In the prep school where I went, Northeastern Prep School. So I saw no, the only misuse, if there was a misuse, was in the factory, in the chem factory. Let me give you an example. We worked on a base of piecework. There was a huge belt every 10 feet or so. There were machines every 10 feet or so. And the cans, coffee cans, Chase and Sanborn coffee cans, pound coffee cans, came through that belt. And you picked up one of those cans as it came through you and put the bottom and stuck it in a machine. That's where I got all my cuts. And then a girl worked next to you. She picked up the one that did it and put it in a box. And you worked on the base of piecework. And they paid, I think it was 25 cents for 100 cans. Then as you became more efficient, you produced more, but instead of paying you 25 cents for 100, they reduced the rate to 20 cents, so you wouldn't make any more. That's the reason I've always been a Democrat, I think, in the sense that the management had no pity of any kind. Mm-hmm. It's different now, of course, because you have laws and also trade unions. But that's the only regret, bad feelings I had about the exploitation of the poor immigrant kids. Mm-hmm. We're really kids. All of us worked in those factories in Boston and then in restaurants.
When you arrived and saw this tenement that your brother was living in, saw the work, saw these men and this bathroom down the hall, did you think, I'd just as soon be back in Albania?
I thought of that. I passed through Ellis Island. Mm. But once I passed, yeah, I thought of that. In fact, I came here to stay only for a couple of years, to make some money and go back. You just get used to that. actually, if you don't know anything better, you don't miss it. Because the improvement came gradual. We moved, after 4 years in this terrible place in on Wall Street, there 21 Wall Street, we moved to Roxbury, which was much better. And we had running water there and a bath. And then from there to Huntington Avenue, a pan. So it went gradually, a pan. So it came gradually, little by little.
At the end. This is the end of side two, Mr. Peters, number 177. It's 4:30.